Welcome to the Carnival of Bastards. My name is David Innes.
My name is St. John Carp.
And we are two Doctor Who fans who love Doctor Who so much that we love taking the piss out
now,
of it.
Now, Dave, we've got a contentious fan favourite this time.
A contentious?
It is contentious. Well, the much-debated Brian of Morbius. Now, who is this Brian? What does he want with Morbius? And is he, as Gary Russell seems to think, a former incarnation of the Master?
It is indeed the brain of Morbius. What am I...
I'm sorry, the what? Don't tell me you have the ridiculously misprinted DVD edition.
Yes, I'm afraid I do. And I've been brought up with it. It's kind of like when you've been brought up with a particular spelling or pronunciation. You just can't not say it. So
well,
yes,
I was going to say. I was going to say it's like being brought up with the edited down, with the cliffhangers edited out of a Doctor Who story on VHS.
Well,
then you suddenly see it with cliffhangers, and it doesn't make any goddamn sense.
Well, funny you should mention that, because that's how I saw this story.
Ah.
When I first saw the story, this was back when I was 9, and I was curious about it. I'd watched the Five Doctors, and then the only other Doctor Who VHS we had in the house was the 1980s version of Brain of Morbius, which had been cut because it was too violent. Now, have you ever seen...
Hang on, which bits did they cut? Which bits are violent?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know, have you seen the edited down version?
Oh, not from memory. I mean, I may have seen it way back in the mists of my childhood.
So this is a story that normally goes for 90 minutes, yeah?
Yeah.
It got cut down to 60 minutes.
Duh. That's a significant cut. That's not just cliffhangers. What the hell did they take out of
that? Well, that's the thing. And there was a whole about the violence and things like that was supposedly cut. Now, as I was watching it again, I think the only thing that might have been a little bit cut might have been sort of when the Morbius monster is snapping people's necks. That's about it. Mm. That's the only violent bits are taken. And that would have been a total of maybe 2 minutes. But I think to make it a significant cut, they actually cut out almost every establishing shot, every walking to and from shot. After a while, it's just people going, I can make this a better story. Look at all this waffle. Look at all this walking business. No, I'll have none of that.
And yeah, they cut Philip Maddock, who the hell needs that crap?
Exactly.
I don't even know how you edit the horror out of this story, because it's not, as you said, one or two events when Morbius is throttling someone. It's sort of a pervading sense of horror. Oh, well, Kondo being shot, I'll grant you that.
Well, Now, funny you should mention that.
Oh, God.
As I was watching it, now that scene should have been cut out if it was to be cut out in the crappy 1980s version. But I strongly remember it being still there.
But there's bits of gore as Kondo gets his guts shot out. And you know, what about the brain hitting the floor?
Yeah, well, no, the brain hitting the floor was fine. That was still there, I'm pretty sure.
Hang on, so all of the bits with actual guts, blood, and internal organs... Fine, they left that in. But walking and talking, now we can cut that.
Yes, because it wasn't until I watched this proper version that I actually saw Solon's castle. It's like, oh my god, he actually lived somewhere.
It looks kind of like, we could probably do without it. It looks like a circus big top.
But do you know the reason why I know that the Kondo scene being shot was still in there?
Well, it's an iconic bit. Why? How do you know?
The music.
Oh, yeah.
Because this is the only part that I have to say. Now, as is commonly my bugbear with these stories about music, this is one of the few stories where Dudley Simpson actually backs the hell off. Because his whole score is wonderfully subtle and beautiful, and you got that wonderful chanting, and it's fantastic. But there's this one moment where, you know, Kondo's threatening, Kondo is shot, he's stumbling around, and he get this wobble, 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 wobble.
It's a bit more sinister than a wop wop.
It is not. It is exactly what it sounds.
Put some phlegm into it, will ya?
What?
Put some phlegm into it. Okay. Bam, 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 bam.
Well, okay, so they may be more bar than war, but either way, it's still inappropriate.
Your bars are too woppy. This is your problem.
That's been my problem with my dating life, I think. His music score, brilliant just that moment. And that's why I...
That's true. I agree.
That moment is what sticks in my head from when I was watching it when I was younger, and
I remember that scene better from... Was it More Than 30 Years in the TARDIS, the documentary where they were talking about violence, and they show that clip of Kondo being shot?
No, I haven't watched More Than 30 Years in the TARDIS in a gazillion years. The only thing I remember from More Than 30 Years in the TARDIS is the end credits, where
you don't remember the companion music that they play Roberta Tovey singing Who is Doctor Who.
Yes, I remember that. I remember those stupid links.
No, you remember that because I showed you, I played that song for you. You didn't remember it before.
Oh no, excuse me. I remember hearing it, but I would have blocked out most of the tune out of my head.
Oh, I think they're re-releasing that. I heard a rumor that they're re-releasing that later this year because they probably need something to go along with the two missing episodes they've just found. They can't release those on their own.
Bumper edition of crap.
Hang on, we're all looking forward to the missing episodes. They're just padding it out with some more than 30 years in the TARDIS.
Come on.
What?
No matter how much we're looking forward to missing episodes, no one wants more underwater menace.
Do you remember when we tried to watch that?
This is a story. Now, I can watch Reconstructions. I just want to put it out there for those who think I'm poo-pooing Reconstructions. Because I don't care about modern fans. I love the Celestial Toymaker. That was just fantastic. From start to end.
Yeah, I agree.
It's a wonderful... that's a wonderful Reconstruction. But... trying to watch. I don't think we even finished Underwater Menace.
We didn't finish. We got about halfway through episode 2 and then just gave up because it was that boring. We didn't even get to see them cut open Polly, which we were all looking forward to. You know, give us some fucking gills.
Misogyny's right up your alley?
I didn't say misogyny. I just said we all want to kill Polly. The fact that she's a woman is completely incidental. Now, Brian of Morbius, I think, is the story that we're on.
And I'm talking about Reconstructions.
Well, I'm not saying there's anything really shit in it, but there's a lot of nitty gritty in this as well. It's not just good stuff. There is also like good discussion points.
Well, I have no issues with the title sequence. Just letting you know.
Oh God!
But one thing, I just want to use this story as to back up my argument of why the start of Death to the Daleks is made out of arse.
Come on.
The reason why... Now, look at the intro to the story. Got a spaceship. We've got an alien mutt trying to claw its way out, trying to put bits and things together. We have Kondo, who we don't know yet, is trying to attack him, and then we get him attacking the alien off-screen. That, my dear friend and Terry Nation, is how you build an interesting start. If you just have some guy wandering down a quarry and been shot by an arrow, that is not suspense. This, my friend, is suspense.
Well, I'm sure Robin Bland would be very glad to hear you say that.
Well, I think he would be. Actually, do you know why Terrence Dix had huge issues with this story?
The story was that it was sort of half written by Bob Holmes and half by Terrence Dix, and they each hated each other's work, wasn't that it?
No, Terrence Dix was a mighty huge fan of Robert Holmes, in fact.
Well, yeah, but they argued over this story.
They did argue the story because of how it was rewritten. Now, what happened was that Terrence Dix wrote a story, then he buggered off on holiday, and Robert Holmes went, oh dear God, no. And he had to rewrite it. Because the character of Solon was actually a robot.
I still don't think Solon is very well written in this. All of the character's massive personality and presence and memorability are thanks to Philip Maddock, who delivers the lines not in the really obvious, well, what a magnificent head you have. He actually delivers it with subtlety as if he's actually saying it in real life. Which sounds obvious, you know, that's the whole point of acting. But if it's so obvious, why don't more people do it?
Because people are shit, Sinjin. People are shit.
You see it in the repartee between Sarah and the Doctor in this one as well. Even though it was Sarah and the Third Doctor in Death to the Daleks, which we did previously, that was such a wooden exchange. But now, Elizabeth Sladen and Tom Baker are just sparkling.
Well, that's because that they look at their status. It's like equal status. That Sarah Jane has moments where she wanders off, she says things, she makes bright things. The Doctor is not a patronising git.
Yes. To the actor's credit, they also put a fair number of ad-libs into this story, I think. Like, Elizabeth Sladen, when they first meet Solon, the Doctor says, oh yes, I've had a few heads, I used to have an old grey model. Some people liked it. And Sarah ad-libs that line, I liked it. Which is so sweet.
It just shows that they're so comfortable with each other. I mean, Tom Baker had the classic ad-lib, can I borrow a glass of water?
Oh, God, that's good. It took me years to get that joke, and I love it so hard.
I will have to contest with you reason why I think Solon is brilliantly written.
Really? You think?
I'm going to sit here with my narrative and my character hat on. why he's brilliantly written, and the whole reason he's brilliantly written is it's the entire story. This is Doctor Who done right. This is the trope version of Doctor Who. This is Doctor Who going into another story. So this is clearly a sort of mystical Frankenstein slash Hammer horror type story, and we've got all the Hammer horror Frankenstein archetypes, and they're all playing exactly what you do. For instance, the dialogue spouted off by Solon is memorable. It's that classic Vincent Price or classic Peter Cushing, Christopher Lee type dialogue where he's like, you meddlesome hussy, you know, though actually that's more Graham Crowden, but you know, it's like, you miserable fool, you cabbage brain, blah blah blah.
He calls Hag and a Harrod, and he keeps slinging lots of names at Maren.
And that's classic Robert Holmes, and it's brilliant, and I love it, and Philip Maddock is enjoying himself immensely.
Yes.
But you are right. I will grant that he brings a level of gravitas that, say, if you replaced him with, I don't know, Graham Crowden,
or Anthony
you
Ailey.
Might go, bah! Bah! Rather than this wonderful, beautiful pathos. Did you like my impression, by the way?
I don't know what that was, but I loved it. It sounded like your appendix just exploded.
It kind of did. Because there's a lot of ham actors who do that. And I think in that Philip Hinchcliffe era, there are beautifully hammy characters that are played with such gravitas. Like, Seeds of Doom is another one. Harrison Chase.
Oh, yeah.
Harrison Chase.
Yeah, that's true.
Is the ultimate villain there. You know, and he does...
And he gets a lot of hammy lines about, you know, fertilizer and plants, which could have just been way over the top, but he delivers them with a level of dignity that you don't get in villains too often.
Well, exactly, and he does it really well, and that's the same with Philip Maddock. And of course, we do want to mention how well Philip Maddock is, because he is sorely missed. He did pass away within a few weeks ago.
Yes, he died like a couple of days after we... said that we were going to do Brain of Morbius.
Which makes me worried about any other story choice that we make.
Well, let's not do a Tom Baker story next, I'll tell you what. He's been on his last legs for some time now.
Philip Maddock, I think I wish that he was... there's a few Doctor Who sort of, you know, secondary characters, secondary actors that get brought up again and again. For instance, like Cyril Shapps. If your story needs a worried old man, wheel out Cyril Shapps.
He's been in, what, at least three stories? Tomb of the Cybermen, Planet of Spiders, and... oh, what was the other one? Androids of Tara.
But he was also in The Ambassadors of Death as well.
Was he?
Yes, playing...
God almighty.
Worried old man.
Well, hang on, what's his name? What's his name also plays worried old man? The guy who played Charlie the Barman and Kerensky from City of Death.
Yes, David Graham. And he was also...
David Graham.
He was also the slightly seedy Dalek voice. Where are the masters of Earth?
When he's not in a Dalek costume, he always looks really put upon until he gets killed.
So those people are brought back again. Bernard Horsfall is brought again and again as one of David Maloney's personal favourite people to bring back. He was a Time Lord in the War Games. He was also brought... he was a Thal in Planet of the Daleks. And then he was the Time Lord, the evil bastard Time Lord in Deadly Assassin.
What evil bastard Time Lord? What are you talking about?
Roth, Hoth. Both.
Oh, Goth. Goth. Goth, you fool. It's an English word. Roth, Hoth, Smock. What was his name?
Shut up!
Smock, Lord President of Gallifrey. Lord President Smock.
All praise Smock. All praise Smock.
Well, speaking of the High Council of Time Lords, actually, I see Morbius as a kind of Hitler character. Somebody who was brought to power legitimately, and then kind of took over in a way that no one really predicted he would. Is that the general understanding of Morbius's history, do you think?
Well, yes. From my understanding, and now you know the books more than I do, and there's a huge long history about Khan and about...
Oh, I'd forgotten. I don't know that.
Oh, right. Well, from my understanding, there's a big sort of fan theory in their books and things like that, that the Sisterhoods of Khan were the original rulers of Gallifrey.
Oh.
And then Rassilon kicked them out, and that's why they left a curse on them, so that they were sterile, and you get your stupid looms.
Oh, is that
looms,
what that was in, Lungbarrow? I wondered what the hell was going on, because there was some bit of Time Lord mythology about a curse that I wasn't quite up with.
Yes, that was that business.
Okay. they're still pretty friendly, though. I mean, they're suspicious of each other, but in Brain of Morbius, we know they work together to a certain extent.
Yeah, well, that's why I don't like the whole kicking out theory, because it makes them sound like they're going to shoot them down. No, I think that they are, you know, they were happy people, and they're sort of like Time Lord equals, except without the time. So they could do all the mind crap. But yeah, Morbius was just an asshole.
Morbius was an asshole, sure, but he seems to have brought knowledge of the Time Lords to other planets, because humans, like Solon, seem to know all about the Time Lords.
Well, that was the thing, because there's that wonderful line I'll mention about the cult of Morbius, which is basically brown shirts, or whatever else you want to describe that with your World War II analogy. And he...
I don't know if there's a really good World War II analogy, but I think Morbius personally has a lot of parallels with Hitler.
Well, yeah, well, there is definitely that. It was... I think it was the cases that, from what I understand from the dialogue and the backstory, that Morbius was one of these people that disagreed with the whole observation, and that he believed the Time Lords should take over the universe. And...
Well, yeah, you definitely get a hint of that from the way Solon talks about the Time Lords being spineless parasites and you know, pale and limpid. And...
Well, isn't that classic, like, you know, being brainwashed? Classic.
Well, yeah, exactly. He's clearly got all of his information from Morbius. Well, how much interaction do you think the Time Lords had with outside planets then?
Well, from memory, if I remember my Doctor Who history correctly, wasn't there the whole plot line in what's that terrible Tom Baker story, Underworld, where the Time Lords were involved in had discovered Minyos and given them all this technology, yeah. And then bugging up the planet to which they went,
were they humans, though, or were they someone else?
Oh, they were another planet or something like that. But that was...
They were another planet or something like
Shut
that.
Shut up! I'm doing my best!
God, I'm glad we've got an expert here on the show with us. So I could... It's like, you know, looking into a mirror that answers all of your questions. David, what race are the Minyos? I don't know, some planet crap.
You're an ass. So the Minyos were another race, a humanoid race from some planet that the Time Lords came in when, I could give you all lots of technology to make you better. They did, and then they started killing each other. The Time Lords tugged their collective collars and realized, nope. Won't do this again. So they went and bugged it off. So they had seen, they know every planet, but whether or not they actually get involved is another matter. Until Morbius came along, Morbius went, I am going to affect other planets. And of course, people like Solon were found out. I think Solon was probably handpicked by Morbius because, you know, he was so good at his job. You know, he could put brains back in things. He could sew people up together. It would be excellent to have on staff. Almost like your Dr. Mengele, if you will, Adolf Hitler. And has about the same level of morals.
They do seem to have been quite chummy at one point.
Oh, yes.
Actually, moral-wise, I love how dismissive Solon is of Sarah at the start. He's so focused on the Doctor and on Morbius that he's utterly dismissive of Sarah. The what girl? Oh, killer. And utterly forgets that Kondo might have feelings about his arm when they unveil the body. He doesn't even think that other people are there and have emotional reactions. Is he a sociopath like that? Or is he just really obsessed?
Well, it's a little of both, because he's got... if you use a theatre terminology, he's got an internal mantra, which is, I must save Morbius. That's going through his head. So anything that does not achieve that goal of his internal mantra is ignored. And so Kondo is clearly just a person to be, you know, slap around. And I love it because Kondo raises his status. There's a few times where he goes from low status to high status and starts threatening Solon. And it's wonderful. And I really love it because he doesn't become generic horrible assistant. He doesn't just become a catchphrase. He becomes a real...
You get some flashes of personality, like when... Well, it's cliche, but when he likes Sarah. But then when he turns on Solon or, you know, is afraid of the sisterhood.
It's all real, and it's brilliant, and I love it. And I think that it's so... acted with such wonderful pathos, and I love it. Now that you brought, you know, you've decided to take the shine off this story.
What shine? I didn't take any shine. Who are you accusing of shine taking?
Oh, You've been de-shining this story.
That's the point of this entire show,
well,
isn't it?
Well, now you're, there's only one, one actor, I think, is terrible throughout this, and that's Michael Spice, the voice of the Brain of Morbius. Because
he doesn't cover himself in glory, but I think he does a decent job.
He does what Michael Wisher realized you could have done, and he avoided. Michael Wisher as Davros realized that you needed to go up and down with voice and volume and so forth. But Michael Spice plays Morbius at one level, which is, no, the sponge has more life than I.
Reduced to the condition where I envy a vegetable.
Yes, and it's all at that same sort of high, angry.
I'm sorry, was Morbius making the music for this story? Because yeah, your impression of yes. Morbius is exactly the same as your impression of the music in this story.
He just shouts. He shouts all the time. And yes, you could argue that if you're a brain in a jar who's slightly paranoid, that's exactly what you'd do too. I would rather have him sort of, you know, had more levels. He was calmed down.
He does get a bit more frenetic, like when Sarah discovers him and he thinks that the sisterhood's found him. He absolutely flips his lid. I think it's a thoroughly tolerable performance. You know, it's not that bad.
I'm not saying it's bad at all. I'm just saying if I was to pinpoint, that'd be the only thing I would have loved to have seen more. Humanistic or more characteristics, more levels.
Well, maybe, but Morbius is actually hardly in it at all. We get a few lines of dialogue from him as the brain, and then we get a few lines of dialogue from him in the body. But Solon's the villain for most of it. Solon's the one who gets far, far more to do and more scenes.
You're right, and there's a reason for that. I'm not criticizing that. Actually, I tell you what, even though. I wonder if what this story would be like if you didn't mention the brain in the title. If it was just called Morbius or The Return of Morbius or whatever else, or The Resurrection of Morbius, I don't know, whatever.
Well, I thought Brain of Morbius gave too much away, but calling it Resurrection of Morbius is even worse.
Yeah, I know.
You know, there's no suspense when the doctor is hanging around saying, Morbius? Morbius is dead. But wait, I felt something. If it's called The Resurrection of Morbius, I think it's safe to say that he's going to come back at some point.
Or it's just a different title that doesn't. Because it's such a wonderful surprise when you see the talking brain.
I do like the talking brain. I thought it was very effective.
It really is very good. And I'll tell you who else is really, really good. And I don't know how much you know about this, but the actress playing Maren.
Yeah.
The elder, I think she does a brilliant job playing to her trope that she is mystical lady and, you know, doesn't bog down in science. That's her job. She was the same age as Elizabeth Slater.
What, seriously? How? How much makeup did they slather on her?
That was all old age makeup. And when she sacrifices herself at the end and you see her old self and then her young self, the young self is the actual actress without makeup.
Seriously, I thought she looked completely different and that they just substituted some younger looking woman instead. But you reckon that's actually her?
That's her, because...
How is BBC old person makeup in the 70s better than BBC old person makeup now? Because if you look at the new series, every old person looks exactly the same. The old Lazarus and the old Doctor are identical.
I can't answer that question, because, I mean, I think that makeup was given more time and effort. I mean, look at Davros in Genesis of the Daleks. That's a beautiful
mask. That's true, but they've got the budget and time and expertise now, don't they?
The other thing is that I suppose that Brain of Morbius is not under the scrutiny of high def.
But I've seen similar productions from that era, like I, Claudius, which uses a lot of aging makeup, and I, Claudius looks great, but you can sort of see the latex peeling off at the edges of people's noses and things. Whereas in Morbius, Maren looks perfect. I never once suspected that she had any prosthetic old person stuff on.
What helps makeup is the actor or actress, and she does Cynthia Grenville, I think her name is. She does a really beautiful job. Nails that role perfectly that you cannot tell. I love everything with the sisterhood. I love the chance. The only bit of the chance, if I was to niggle, is when they do, when I think Solon comes and bursts in and they do that death, 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 death. I would have actually...
I like that.
It's the death that...
It gives you something to chant along to.
It's great, but It's
part of the Brain of Morbius drinking game. Green wine. It has to come with green wine.
Excellent. But when they do chant that this, none of the girls are actually saying it. I would have wanted the girls to say it. And they're just standing
still.
I got still.
The impression there's more of them.
It sounds like a voiceover and not real. That's the only criticism. It sounds great. It just doesn't look as real. But speaking of that wine, the green wine, I'm glad that Sarah had the idea that it might be a bit iffy. But I'll tell you what is what makes that whole situation so much better is when they come back and Solon goes, "Ah, you survived. More wine." You know, what part of him is thinking this idea will work the second time?
Well,
clearly they will not have linked.
He's utterly clueless because he doesn't know what to do. I mean, these people who he never expected to see again have just shown up and are sitting at his dining table right after he tried to kill them. And this is right after he said, you know, "Take the doctor, but give me his head."
Yes.
So he's not expecting them to just turn up without some kind of a bargaining chip or a weapon, and yet they're just sitting there in his living room, you know.
And I love it. It's delivered perfectly, and Philip Madoc is wonderful. And in fact, I have note here that, you know, I think Solon is wonderful, and Philip Madoc could make anything classy. I think he could read the phone book, and it would be engaging. He could... any production could be better with more Philip Madoc.
You know what I like? When Philip Madoc lies in this story, when Solon lies, because he tells the Doctor that Sarah's permanently blinded and that he needs to go to the Sisterhood. So he tricks the Doctor into going back to the Sisters. And we think that he could still be telling the truth at this point, but as the Doctor leaves, Solon sort of grins to himself. And it's a fantastically subtle moment because it's not the really hammy kind of lying that you get in other stories, like The Ark, where Dodo says, you know, "You're up to something, aren't you?" And the Monoid goes, no, I'm up to anything? No, I don't think so.
Yeah, it's played for absolute real, and I would say if you had any lesser actor playing that role, you'd get the same problem. He plays it so real, and that's why I think that any role that Philip Madoc plays is brilliant, and I have a feeling there's a third story, but the only one I can think of is The War Games, where he plays the war chief.
I didn't know that was
or
him.
The warlord. The really subtle, sinister
it's
one.
It's not subtle. I hate that role.
What? I'm talking about I think he's the warlord.
Oh, wait, hang on.
I'm talking about the guy who gets dematerialized by the Time Lords in the end.
The guy with the glasses?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Sorry, no, I thought you meant the security chief or the guy with the really high-pitched, stupid voice.
Oh, no, not the security
chief. I will report you to the warlord.
You will answer. No, not him, no. I did mean the actual good actor.
Right, right, okay. No, I would never have picked that as the same guy.
No, that is, and he does such a wonderful job, and you can see hints of it in the two roles. There is another story he's in, and I can't remember, but I know that he did appear in one of the Dalek movies, but that's all I can remember. Either case, brilliant. Very sad loss to the world. Oh, I know what he appeared in. He did one of the Big Finish audios. That's why I remember.
Oh, did
that.
He? What did Solon come back?
No, he played a different character. He played in one of a story called Master with Sylvester McCoy and Jeffrey Beavers.
Well, you know what I think is strange about how Solon dies in this is that it's given almost no dramatic emphasis. You think he might just have passed out and will be coming to later, but that's it. That's his exit from the story. A little cough, and then he sort of rolls over.
Yeah, well, I suppose cyanide will do that to you.
Well, yeah, but I never expected that to be his death scene, because death scenes in Doctor Who are usually like Kondo with, you know, gigantic music and dramatic shots and everything. But this is so played down that you don't even know what's happening.
And that's why it's brilliant. Unlike, say, the seeming rule of Genesis of the Daleks, where if you look at Genesis of the Daleks, the more important you are, the more elaborate your death spasm is. You've got, you know, Johnny Nobody gets, like, just falls to the ground, and then you've got Nida, who has to clutch his stomach, then wobble forward, then look behind him, run backwards, go on a wall and slide down.
Bronson also takes about 5 minutes to die, doesn't he?
Probably, yeah.
What do you mean, probably? He's got the really famous violence death scene from that story, because he was the good guy, at least. Nida, we don't quite care about.
No, that's true. Nida gets his comeuppance. No, you're right. And that's why I really like it. It's played so realistically. He doesn't have a Graham Crowden giggly laugh to death.
What is this? What have you got it in for Graham Crowden for? I like Graham Crowden.
He's exactly what the Hordes of Nymon needed. But I would not...
My dream of conquest!
Because the Hordes of Nymon is shit. And he was needed to, you know, out-ham Tom Baker at that point. He would have been awful in any other context. Did you know Graham Crowden could have almost been the fourth Doctor?
Yes, I heard about that, but he turned it down.
Because he didn't want to be, you know, in a regular series or whatever else. And, oh, thank God.
No, I think that might have been fascinating to see. I don't know if Doctor Who would have cracked the American market in that case, but I would have loved to see Graham Crowden in the role.
No.
That man could play the Queen, and he'd be great.
No!
Yeah. We are not amused!
Told from my research, this is one of the few times where the Doctor actually kills sort of a human character.
Yeah, he does. I can see why they don't spend much time on that, because it is perfectly justified. They are locked in, they're going to die. And if Morbius were to be resurrected, then it would be catastrophic beyond all measurements. So... I can understand why he did it, but it is kind of curious that he doesn't make any remarks.
Because normally the Doctor's all like, oh, I can't kill people, whatever else, and here he does. But it's all...
He gave Solon a chance as well, though. It's not like he didn't...
Yeah, well, Solon
try to save him.
But, I mean, that's kind of stupid judgment. This is a guy who's like...
Yeah, that was such a bizarre thing. Why did they not just throw Morbius off a cliff right then and there instead of the Doctor going, oh, yeah, I'll take him back to your lab where you can fix him for... God knows what.
That you can disassemble him. I mean, really, yeah. just throw him off a cliff, you clown.
That's what happened in the end. You mentioned this is an archetypical Doctor Who story where the Doctor walks into somebody else's story and tries to fix things.
That's the thing. This is Doctor Who done well. Doctor Who done well is when they take an existing archetype story and put the Doctor in it, because everyone has... we as the audience... have more feelings to what the characters are. Because we have an expectation that Solon is a mad scientist, we layer our own experiences of mad scientist onto him. So we don't need to hear about his backstory. We already imagine what his backstory is. We see these crazy ladies in the Sisterhood of Khan. We know that they're some sort of cult group. So we layer our experiences of what cult groups are onto them.
Hang on, are you arguing for ripping off other people's stories because the public is already familiar with them?
Yes, I am, actually. Because compared to, say, Death of the Daleks, we've got bland military. I've got no experience of seeing bland space patrol, so I've got really nothing to layer on them in my own personal thing to give them meaning.
What personal experience do you have with mad scientists and crazy sisterhoods?
Well, what I've seen, what I've watched, my experience of
watching.
Yeah,
what you've seen and what you've watched, but there are military patrols in everything.
Oh, there
I don't
are
know why
not.
You're saying you haven't got any experience. Yes, there are.
There are not space patrols in anything, or if they're done, they're done terribly dull or boring that I don't watch. You know, the only experience I have with space patrols are sort of 1950s beam movies. If you want to say that my experience of watching Plan 9 from Outer Space is somehow going to make Death of the Daleks better, what the hell sort of argument have we got there?
Hang on, you're being retarded. 1950s B-movies aren't worth watching for archetypes, but Frankenstein is. What do you think Frankenstein is?
No, I'm not saying... You're twisting my words. What I'm saying
is
that... No,
it's because you're being inconsistent.
Oh, your face is inconsistent. No, what this is that this is where classic stories that we have seen are used as a feel, and our experiences of knowing these archetypes are really good. All I'm saying is that space patrol people, there's not that many great experiences in watching and enjoying space patrol based stories.
Didn't Mary Shelley write about space patrol people, or was that a Jane Austen novel? Speaking of archetypal stories, though, I think it's interesting that we know what to expect of the Doctor in any given story. He's an archetype we have experience with from the past, you know, 10 or 20 years. But this story begins with him utterly abandoning his own role. you know, given the perfect mystery that Sarah stumbles upon, the crashed spaceships, the headless body, it's all very exciting. The Doctor just goes, nope, not doing it. I'm not doctoring this time.
And, yeah, and that's a really wonderful start. And
I think so.
That whole start, it's all mystery. It's all a great, it's a great alternative to how we do normally start the story. And that's why I love it. And I love how everything is served well, how the narrative is served well. Like, there's a great bit when the Doctor is first captured by the Sisterhood, and he starts gabbling on about science, and as soon as he gabbles enough, we get a gong, and it's time for sacrifice. Great way to get people to shut up, is make a clock chime, get a gong to go off, make a sacrifice happen, whatever happens.
Well, we know the kind of thing he's about to babble on about, so it doesn't matter that it's interrupted.
And that is part of the whole archetype of that story.
You're right, I think it's extremely clever.
And it uses... I'm not trying to say that, no, we should just have Doctor Who and the, I don't know, Doctor Who and the Carry On movie, or Doctor Who and the whatever else, where we're just taking an existing film and shoving people in it. I'm just saying it works well when we know of the type of...
Did you say Doctor Who and the Carry On movie?
Yes, because I was, for some reason, the only film I could think of.
I can see Doctor Who and Hammer, which is basically what we've got here, but Doctor Who and Carry On? What would that even look like? Would that be... That'd be a Donald Cotton script, surely.
I was about to say, that would be the Gunfighters, surely, wouldn't it?
I was going to say the Mythmakers, because there are lots of cracks about sex in that one, probably more so than in the Gunfighters.
Yeah, so there are examples where that happens, and I think, to defend Death of the Daleks, if I had been brought up the same way Terry Nation had, which was reading a lot of boys' adventure magazines, writing boys' adventure magazines, and listening to the serials and whatever else, I would love Death of the Daleks, because I would have such great experience in loving that kind of military space patrol type thing.
Isn't that what you grew up with, cartoons, when you watch when you're a kid?
No.
It's all...
No, not really. The kind of cartoons that I like, the only real boys' adventure cartoon I like was Tintin. But even that was going into the surreal. So, you know, the cartoons that I like were just sort of fun, you know, really, I suppose almost fairy tale quality, because I'm just thinking about any cartoon I ever watched, things like the Smurfs, or things like Adventure Penguins, or Count Duckula, or anything like that. They're all somewhat weird, and, you know, the Trapdoor.
Oh, well, Trapdoor, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I feel bad, I didn't want to seem like I was attacking the premise of what you were saying there. I just didn't feel I was making myself clear. And I just think that when Doctor Who taps into something we already know, that's the best kind of Doctor Who. Like, that's why Autons are successful, because we know about plastic things, and that's why, you know, the science of the library is great. We know what shadows are. Even things like Fires of Pompeii taps into your... is very much Doctor Who falls into an Asterix comic. And so it's all that... all that sort of experience makes Doctor Who so much better.
Really? I don't know that I agree to the extent that you're saying. Well, I never watched Fires of Pompeii and thought, oh, it's an Asterix comic. Horror certainly works by taking familiar elements and turning them against you, hence shadows and statues in the case of Blink.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, in the end, that's not the reason why I love it. The reason why I love it is that great moral choice at the end, that wonderful, powerful ending. That's the reason why I love The Fires of Pompeii. But I'm saying...
The story itself is a bit shit, although I do like that ending.
But take Happiness Patrol, one of the other poorly, poorly misunderstood stories of all. I just cannot understand how people cannot like The Happiness Patrol.
I came round on that one. I used to hate it, but... upon subsequent washings, I liked it a lot more.
And that has this wonderful... It's a play on Margaret Thatcher. It's a play on totalitarianism. It's a play on everything. But then again, just like your argument there, I used to hate Paradise Towers until I watched it again and went, oh, this is actually one of the most brilliant pieces of television I've ever watched.
I'm glad you think so. I recently linked someone to it who will have no interest in it, but we were talking about Cannibal Grannies, and how can you not bring up Paradise Towers?
I love Paradise Towers, and it's not just because of the grannies. I just love the whole concept of this, and I just think it's one of the most beautiful sets.
Oh, it's great. I love the language in it, you know, the idea that the Kangs have sort of lost proper English and have created their own slang. I love Pax being utterly useless at everything.
The only thing is I even forgive the crappy machines. I forgive the
crappy... I like the crappy machines, like when they eat Tabitha, and then you see her, like, foot with a nighty and a slipper sticking out the bin of the machine as it's taking her away. Brilliant! They did have to kind of throw themselves into the machine's claws.
But nonetheless, it was still really good. But at the end of The Brand of Morbius, the only thing that I actually realized watching this again, how much science is mentioned and about geology, but it was still fine. The only thing is, since this was the second story I ever watched, so I'd seen The Five Doctors and I'd seen this story, and both stories, the TARDIS leaves differently. Like, in The Five Doctors, the TARDIS separates in the five different TARDISes. This time...
Yeah, what is with the Flash?
Yeah, this confused me as a kid. It's like, does the TARDIS normally do this? Because it's really awesome if it does.
I thought he was demonstrating, like, the thing he used to clear the soot. I mean, because that's what he's just given Ohika. And it's what he's talking about as the TARDIS takes off. What is that? What is that about?
Yeah, I don't know. But I still think it's great. And it's
could
fun.
Check out the novelization. I tell you what, for next time I'll see if I can't find out from the novelization if it says anything. Yeah.
It probably is, knowing because it's written by Terrence Dix. No doubt it's just the TARDIS leaves with a bang and a flash. The end.
I was going to say a wheezing, groaning
noise.
Wheezing,
groaning, bang, flash.
Yes. God, that sounds like dates I've had.
And on that note, that's the end of The Brain of Morbius. I loved it.
We wrap up The Brain of Morbius. We both love it. Who doesn't?
I actually feel like I could use this to convert people. Watching it again, I feel like it's a great...
I was thinking that too, but I think there may be a little bit too much Time Lord lore in it.
I think there's just enough to describe the Doctor. I don't think there's too much. I think it's still great. And I'm going to try. I'm going to see at one point, I'm going to try and convert people to it using it. And see how I go. I mean, Spearhead from Space is my usual go-to.
Oh, I tried that one, and I think it's too long. It takes too long to get into the story. It's not a typical Doctor Who story.
What would you use, then?
Oh, well, we've had this discussion before. I think a Douglas Adams one, because people know Douglas Adams, and stories like City of Death really are top-rate stories.
All right, that's fair.
And they stand on their own.
With their disco
they really get
dances.
They dive into the action, rather than Spearhead from Space, which takes about 2 or 3 episodes for anything to happen.
Okay, I would disagree, but that's alright, that's for another discussion. So,
I've been wanting to go back to Doctor Who's roots. We are doing Doctor Who, and I'd really love to do a First Doctor story.
Oh, alright.
I'll pick the Romans if I get my choice, because it's one of my favourites.
It is your choice, so next time we shall be watching the Romans. But until then, this has been the Carnival of Bastards. I'm David Innes.
I'm St. John Carr.
And
your head. What a magnificent head!
A sponge has more life than I!
Reduced to the condition, would I envy a vegetable?